slicing through the inky murk. She became aware that something was moving in the water, a shadowy bulk gliding just beneath the surface. It appeared to be following her, maintaining a watchful distance. Her mind did not register its presence as menacing. Rather, it merely seemed to be a natural feature of the environment, one she might have anticipated if she'd thought about it in advance. "Your boat is very small," said Amy. She was sitting in the stern. Water was running from her face and hair. "You know we can't go," Amy stated. The remark was puzzling. Alicia continued to row. "Go where?" "The virus is in us." Amy's voice was dispassionate, without any perceptible tone. "We can't ever leave." "I don't understand what you're talking about." The shape had begun to circle them. Great bulges of water began to rock the boat from side to side. "Oh, I think you do. We're sisters, aren't we? Sisters in blood." The motion increased in intensity. Alicia drew the oars into the boat and clutched the gunwales for balance. Her heart turned to lead. Bile bubbled in her throat. Why had she failed to foresee the danger? So much water all around them, and her little boat, so small as to be nothing. The hull began to rise. Suddenly they were no longer in contact with the water. A great blue bulk emerged under them, water streaming from its encrusted flanks. "You know who that is," Amy said impassively. It was a whale. They were balanced like a pea atop its immense, horrible head. Higher and higher it lifted them into the air. One flick of its monstrous tail and it would send them soaring. It would crash down upon them and smash their boat to pieces. A hopeless terror, that of fate, took her in its grasp. From the stern, Amy issued a bored sigh. "I'm so tired of him," she said. Alicia tried to scream, but the sound stopped in her throat. They were rising. The sea was falling away. The whale was looming up. She awoke with a slam. She blinked her eyes and tried to focus. It was night. She was in the back of the truck, and the truck was bouncing hard. Sarah's face floated into view. "Lish, what is it?" Her lips moved slowly around the words. "They're coming." From the rear of the convoy, the sound of guns. Shit. Shit, shit, shit. Michael took the stairs from the pilot house three at a time. He raced across the deck, his feet barely touching steel, and down the hatch. He was yelling into his radio, "Rand, get down here right now!" He hit the engineering catwalk at a sprint, grabbed the poles of the ladder, and slid the rest of the way. The engines were quiet. Everything stopped. Rand appeared above him. "What happened?"
"Something tripped the main."
Lore on the radio.
"Michael, we're hearing shots up here."
"Say again?"
"Gunshots, Michael. I'm looking down the isthmus now. We've got lights coming this way from the mainland. Headlights or virals?" "I'm not sure."
He needed current to trace the problem. At the electrical panel, he switched diagnostics over to the auxiliary generator. The meters jumped to life.
"Rand!" Michael bellowed. "What are you seeing?"
Rand was positioned at the engine control array on the far side of the room, checking dials.
"Looks like it's something in the water jacket pumps." "That wouldn't trip the main. Look farther up the line."
A brief silence. Then Rand said,
"Got it."
He tapped a dial.
"Pressure's flatlined on the starboard side charger. Must have shut down the system."
Lore again.
"Michael, what's going on down there?"
He was strapping on his tool belt.
"Here," he said, tossing Rand the radio. "You talk to her."
Rand looked lost.
"What should I say?" "Tell her to get ready to engage the props straight from the pilot house."
"Shouldn't she wait for the system to repressurize? We could blow a header."
"Just get on the electrical panel. When I tell you, switch the system back over to the main bus. Michael, talk to me, Lore said. Things are looking very fucking serious up here. Go, Michael told Rand.
He raced aft, plugged in his lantern, dropped to his back, and wedged himself under the charger.
This goddamn leak, he thought. It's going to be the death of me.
The convoy hit the isthmus doing 60 miles an hour. Buses were bounding. Buses were going airborne. The tanker, last in line, had failed to keep up. The virals were close behind and massing. The barrier of razor wire appeared in the headlights. Peter yelled into the radio,
"Everyone keep going! Don't stop!"
They careened straight through the barrier. Chase stamped the brakes and pulled to the side as the convoy roared past with inches to spare, pushing a wall of wind that buffeted the vehicle like a howling gale. Peter, Chase, and Amy leapt from the cab.
Where was the tanker?
It lumbered into view at the base of the causeway. Lamps blazing, engine roaring, traveling toward them like a well-lit rocket in slow motion. Past the turn, it began to accelerate. Two virals were crouched on the roof of the cab. Chase raised his rifle and squinted through the scope.
Ford, don't, Peter warned. You hit that tank, it could blow.
Quiet. I can do this.
A bullet split the air. One of the virals tumbled away. Ford was taking aim at the second when it dropped to the hood. No shot.
Shit.
From the cab, a pair of shotgun blasts came in rapid succession. The windshield shattered outward into the moonlight. There was a hissing groan of brakes. The viral flopped backward into the conical glare of the truck's headlights and disappeared beneath the front wheels with a wet burst. Suddenly, the cab was at a right angle to the causeway. The tanker was jackknifing. The whole thing began to swing crosswise. As its back wheels touched the water, the rear of the truck abruptly decelerated, swinging the cab in the opposite direction like a weight on a string. The truck was less than 100 yards away now. Peter could see Greer fighting the wheel for control, but his efforts were now pointless. The vehicle's angular momentum had assumed command. It flopped onto its side. The cab separated from its cargo, which rammed it from behind in a second crunch of glass and metal. A long, screeching skid, and the whole thing came to rest, lying driver side up at a 45-degree angle to the roadway. Peter dashed toward it, Chase and Amy close behind. Fuel was gushing everywhere. Black smoke billowed from the undercarriage. The virals were funneling onto the isthmus. They would arrive within seconds. Patch was dead, his head crushed from behind. What was left of him was spread-eagled over the dashboard. Greer was lying on top of him, soaked in blood. Was it Patch's or his own? He was staring upward.
Lucius, cover your eyes.
Peter and Chase began to kick what was left of the windshield. Three hard blows and the glass caved inward. Amy climbed inside and took the man by the shoulders while Peter took his legs.
I'm okay, Greer muttered, as if to apologize.
As they hauled him out, the first fingers of flame appeared. Chase and Peter each took a side. They ran. Passengers had massed at the narrow gangway, attempting to shove their way through the bottleneck. Cries of panic stamped the air. Men were scrambling over the deck of the ship to free the chains that held it in place. Many of the children seemed dazed and uncertain, drifting on the dock like a herd of sheep in the rain. Pim and the girls were already on the ship. At the top of the gangway, Sarah was lifting the smallest children aboard, pulling others by the hand to hasten them. Hollis and Caleb were shepherding the children from the rear. A man charged from behind, nearly knocking Hollis over. Caleb grabbed him, threw him to the pavement, and shoved a finger into his face.
You wait your goddamn turn!
They weren't going to make it, Caleb thought. People had resorted to using the chains, attempting to drag themselves hand over hand to the ship. A woman lost her grip. With a cry, she plunged into the water. She came up, her face visible for only a moment, arms waving over her head. She didn't know how to swim. She sank back down. Where were his father and the others? Why hadn't they come? From the causeway, an explosion. All faces turned. A ball of fire was rising in the sky. Wedged under the charger, Michael was trying to trace the faint hiss of leaking gas. "Keep cool," he told himself. "Do this by the numbers, joint by joint." "Anything?" Rand was standing at the base of the charger. "You're not helping." It was no use. The leak was too small. It must have bled for hours. "Get me some soapy water," he called. "I need a paintbrush, too." "Where the hell am I going to get that?" "I don't care. Figure it out." Rand darted away. The blast hit them like a slap, hurling them forward off their feet. Debris whizzed past. Tires, engine parts, shards of metal sharp as knives. As a wall of heat soared over him, Peter heard a scream and a great crunch of metal and splintering glass. He was lying face down in the mud. His thoughts were disordered. None seemed related to any of the others. A rag-like bundle lay to his left. It was Chase. The man's clothes and hair were smoking. Peter crawled to him. His friend's eyes stared sightlessly. Cradling the back of the man's head, he felt something soft and damp. He turned Chase onto his side. The back of the man's skull was gone. The Humvee was totaled, crushed and burning. Greasy smoke clotted the air. It coated the insides of Peter's mouth and nose with its rancid taste. With every breath, it drilled into his lungs, deeper and deeper. "Amy, where are you?" He staggered toward the Humvee. "Amy, answer me!" "I'm here." She was pulling Greer clear of the water. The two of them emerged, covered in gooey mud, and collapsed to the ground. "Where's Chase?" She had pink burns on her face and hands. "Dead." Crouched, he asked Greer, "Can you walk?" The man was holding his head in his hands. Then, glancing up, "Where's Patch?" The burning truck would hold the virals at bay, but once the fires died, the horde would come streaming down the isthmus. The three of them had nothing to fight with except Amy's sword, which still lay in its scabbard over her back. A harsh white light raked their faces. A pickup was racing down the roadway toward them. Peter hooded his eyes against the glare. The driver skidded to a stop. "Get in," Caleb said. Alicia saw only the sky. The sky and the back of a man's head. She sensed the presence of a crowd. Her stretcher jostled beneath her. There were voices, people crying, everything rushing around her. "Don't take me." Her body was broken. She lay loose as a doll. "I'm one of them. I don't belong." Clanging footsteps. They were crossing the gangway. "Put her over there," someone said. The stretcher bearers lowered her to the deck and hurried away. A woman was sitting beside her, her body curled around a blanketed bundle. She was murmuring into the bundle, some kind of repeated phrase that Alicia could not make out, though it possessed the rote rhythm of prayer. "You," Alicia said. One syllable. It felt like lifting a piano. The woman failed to notice her. "You," she repeated. The woman looked up. The bundle was a baby. The woman's grip on it was almost ruthless, as if she feared someone might snatch it away at any moment. "I need you to help me." The woman's face crumpled. "Why aren't we moving?" She bent her face to the baby again, burying it in the cloth. "Oh God, why are we still here?"
"Please, listen."
"Why are you talking to me? I don't even know you. I don't know who you are."
"I'm Alicia."
"Have you seen my husband? He was here a second ago. Has anybody seen my husband?"
Alicia was losing her. In another moment, she'd be gone.
"Tell me her name."
"What?"
"Your baby. Her name."
It was as if nobody had ever asked her such a question.
"Say it,"
Alicia said.
Say her name.
She shook with a sob.
He's a boy, she moaned. His name is Carlos.
A moment passed, the woman weeping, Alicia waiting. There was chaos all around, and yet it felt as if they were alone. She and this woman she did not know, who could have been anyone.
Rose. My Rose, Alicia thought. How I have failed you. I could not give you life. Will you help me?
The woman wiped her nose with the back of her wrist.
What can I do?
Her voice was utterly hopeless.
I can't do anything.
Alicia licked her lips. Her tongue was heavy and dry. There would be pain. A lot of it. She would need every ounce of strength.
I need you to untie my straps.
Soaring leap after soaring leap, Carter made his way down the channel toward the isthmus. The mushroom shapes of chemical tanks, the rooftops of buildings, the great forgotten debris fields of industrial America. He moved swiftly, his power inexhaustible, like a huge heaving engine. A great backlit shape rose before him. The channel bridge. He unleashed his body skyward. Up he flew, seizing a handhold just below the bridge's shattered surface. A moment of calibration and he hurled himself upward again, grabbed a guy wire with one hand, and somersaulted to the deck. Below, the unfolding battle was laid out before him like a model. The ship and the mob of people funneling aboard, the truck roaring down the causeway, the barricade of flames and the viral horde amassed behind it. Carter cocked his head to calculate his arc. He needed more height. Using one of the support wires, he climbed to the top of the tower. The water shone below him still as glass, like a great smooth mirror to the moon. He felt some uncertainty, even a bit of fear. He pushed it aside. The tiniest fleck of doubt and he would fail. He would plummet into the abyss. To traverse such a distance, to master its breadth, one needed to enter an abstract realm. To become not the jumper, but the jump. Not an object in space, but space itself. He compressed to a crouch. Energy expanded outward from his core and gushed into his limbs.
Amy, I am coming.
From the pilot house, Lore was watching the viral horde through binoculars. Blockaded by the flaming wreckage, it appeared as a column of thrumming light that stretched far back onto the mainland and beyond, widening to encompass virtually all of the far shore. She raised the radio to her mouth.
I don't want to rush you, Michael, but whatever's wrong, you have got to fix it right the fuck now. I'm trying here.
Something was happening to the horde. A kind of rippling. A rippling, but also a compacting, like the gathering action of a spring. Beginning at the rear, the motion slithered forward, gathering speed as it proceeded down the causeway toward the flames. The truck was lying lengthwise across the roadway. What was she seeing? The head of the column crashed into the burning tanker like a battering ram. Gouts of smoke and fire shot into the sky. The tanker began to creep forward, scraping along the roadway. Burning virals peeled off into the water as more were propelled from behind into the destruction. Lore looked down from the rail. The chains connecting the hull to the dock had been released. Dozens of people were splashing helplessly in the water. At least 100, including some children, remained on the dock. Panicked cries knifed the air.
Get out of my way! Take my daughter! Please, I'm begging you!
Hollis! She cried.
The man looked up. Lore pointed toward the isthmus. She realized her mistake. Others on the dock had seen her. The mob surged forward, everyone attempting to wedge themselves onto the narrow gangway simultaneously. blows were thrown, bodies hurled, people were trampled in the crush. From the center of the melee came the crack of a gunshot. Hollis rushed forward, arms swinging like a swimmer's, carving a path through the chaos. More shots. The crowd scattered, revealing a lone man with a pistol and two bodies on the ground. For a second, the man just stood there, as if amazed by what he'd done, before he turned and charged up the gangway. Too late for him. He made it all of 5 steps before Hollis grabbed him by the collar, pulled him backward, placed his other hand under the man's buttocks, hoisted him over his head, the man flailing his arms and legs like an overturned turtle, and hurled him over the rail. Lore grabbed the radio.
Michael, it's getting ugly up here.
A froth of bubbles appeared. Rand passed Michael a 3-foot length of pipe and a tub of grease. Michael wrenched the old pipe free, greased the threads of its replacement, and fitted it into place. Rand had returned to the panel.
Switch it over!
Michael yelled. The lights flickered. The mixers began to spin. Pressure flowed into the lines.
Here we go!
Rand cried. Michael wriggled free. Rand tossed him the radio.
Lore!
Everything died again. She had failed. Her army was gone, scattered to dust. With all her heart, Amy wanted to be on that ship, to depart this place and never come back. But she could never leave, not on this boat or any other. She would stand on the dock as it sailed away. How I wanted to have that life with you, Peter, she thought.
I'm sorry. I'm sorry. I'm sorry.
The truck was racing east, Caleb at the wheel, Peter, Amy, and Greer in the cargo bed. Ahead, the lights of the dock loomed. Behind them, across the widening distance, Amy saw the burning tanker pivoting. The first virals appeared through the breach. Their bodies were burning. They staggered forward, man-sized wicks of flame. The gap continued to widen, opening like a door. Amy turned to the window of the cab.
Caleb!
He was looking through the mirror.
I see them!
Caleb floored it. The truck shot forward, sending Amy tumbling. Her head impacted the metal floor with a clang and a burst of disorienting pain. Lying on her back, her face to the sky, Amy saw the stars. Stars by the hundreds, the thousands. And one of them was falling. It grew and grew, and she knew what this star was.
Anthony.
Carter's aim was true. As the truck zoomed past, he landed behind it on the causeway, rolled, and came up on his feet. The virals were careening toward him. He drew himself erect.
Brothers. Sisters.
He sensed their confusion. Who was this strange being who had dropped into their path?
I am Carter, 12th of 12. Kill me if you can.
What the hell happened? I don't know.
The radio squawked.
Lore. Michael, we have got to go right now.
Rand was madly checking gauges.
It's not the charger. It has to be electrical.
Michael stood before the panel in utter desolation. It was hopeless. He was beaten. His ship, his Bergensfjord, had denied him. His paralysis became anger. His anger turned to rage. He slammed a fist against the metal.
You bitch!
He reared back, struck again.
You heartless bitch! You do this to me?
With tears of frustration brimming, he grabbed a wrench from the deck and began to slam it against the metal again and again.
I've given you everything!
A sudden rumble, like the roar of a great caged beast. Lights came on. All the gauges leapt.
Michael, said Rand, what the hell did you do? That's got it,
Lore cried. The sound increased in intensity, humming through the ship's plating. Rand yelled over the din,
Pressure's holding. 8,000 RPM. 12. 20. 35.
Michael snatched the radio from the floor. Engage the screws. A groan. A shudder deep in the bones. The Bergensfjord began to move. They skidded into the loading area. Amy leapt from the back of the truck before it stopped moving. Amy, stop! But the woman was already gone, racing toward the causeway. Caleb, take Lucius and get on that boat! Standing by the cargo bed, his son seemed stunned. Do it, Peter ordered. Don't wait! He took off after her. With every step, he willed himself to go faster. His breath was heaving in his chest, the ground flying beneath him. The gap between them began to narrow. 20 feet. 15. 10. A final burst of speed, and he grabbed her around the waist, sending both of them rolling on the ground.
Let me go.
Amy was on her knees, fighting to break free.
We have to leave right now.
There were tears in her voice.
They'll kill him.
Carter coiled. He flexed his fingers. Claws glinting. He flexed his toes, feeling the taut wires of ligaments. Bluing moonlight doused him like a benediction. Reaching one hand forward, Amy released a wail of pain.
Anthony!
He charged. They had to clear 800 feet. At the rear of the vessel, a wall of foam churned up. Shouts rose from the dock.
They're leaving without us!
The last of the passengers rushed forward, shoving themselves onto the ramp, which had begun to scrape along the pier as the Bergensfjord pulled away. Standing at the rail, Pim watched the scene unfold in silence. The bottom lip of the gangway was inching toward the edge. Soon it would fall. Where was her husband? Then she saw him. Supporting Lucius, he was racing at a quick step down the pier. She began to sign emphatically to any who might see.
That's my husband, and stop this ship!
But of course, no one could make sense of her. The gangway was clotted with people. Crammed between the guardrails, they squeezed forward onto the deck of the ship only one or two at a time, ejected from the squirming mass. Pim began to moan. She was not aware that she was doing this at first. The sound had emerged of its own volition, an expression of violent feeling that could not be contained. Just as 21 years ago, in Sarah's arms, she had wailed with such ferocity that she might have been mistaken for a dying animal. As the volume increased, the sound began to form a distinctive shape altogether new in the life of Pim Jackson. She was about to make words.
Caleb! Run!
The lip of the gangway halted. It had lodged against a cleat at the edge of the pier. Under the pressure of the ship's accelerating mass, it began to twist on its axis. Rivets were popping, metal buckling. Caleb and Greer were steps away. Pim was waving, shouting words she couldn't hear but felt with every atom of her body. The gangway began to fall. Still chained to the ship, it cantilevered into the side of the hull. Bodies plunged into the water, some wordlessly, their fate accepted, others with pitiful cries. At the bottom of the ramp, Caleb had hooked an elbow through the rail while simultaneously holding on to Greer, whose feet were balanced on the lowest rung. The Bergensfjord was gathering speed, dragging a roiling whirlpool. As the stern passed by, the ones in the water were dragged under, into the propeller's froth. Perhaps a cry, a hand reaching up in vain, and they were gone. In the bowels of the Bergensfjord, Michael was running. Deck by deck he ascended, legs flying, arms swinging, heart pumping in his mouth. With a burst he flung himself into open air. The point of the bow was passing the end of the dry dock door. They weren't going to clear it. No goddamn way. He took the stairs to the pilot house, three at a time, and charged through the door.
Lore!
She was staring out the windscreen.
I know. Give it more rudder. You don't think I did that?
The gap between the door and the ship's right flank was narrowing. 20 yards. 10. 5.
Oh, shit,
Lore breathed. Peter and Amy were racing down the dock. The ship was departing. She was gliding away. Gunfire spattered from the fantail, bullets whizzing over their heads. The virals had broken through. A crash. The side of the hull had collided with the end of the dry dock door. A long, scraping sound followed, the irresistible force of the ship's momentum meeting the immovable object of the door's weight. The hull trembled even as it failed to decelerate, thrusting forward. The great wall of steel slid heartlessly by. In another few seconds, the Bergensfjord would be gone. There was no way to board. Peter saw something hanging off the side of the ship. The fallen gangway, still attached at the top. 2 people were clinging to it. Caleb. Greer. With 1 arm crooked around the gangway rail, his son was calling to them while pointing at the end of the pier. The dry dock door had been nudged away from the ship. It now stood at an acute angle to the moving hull. When the gangway passed the end of the door, the gap between them would narrow to a jumpable distance. But Amy was no longer beside him. Peter was alone. He spun and saw her, standing 100 feet behind him, facing away. Amy, come on! Get ready to jump! Caleb yelled. The virals had reached the far end of the pier. Amy drew her sword and called to Peter over her shoulder, Get on that ship!
What are you doing? We can make it!
Don't make me explain. Just go! Suddenly, he understood. Amy did not intend to leave. Perhaps she never had. Then, he saw the girl. Far out of his reach, she was crouched behind a giant spool of cable. Strawberry hair tied with a ribbon, scratches on her face, a stuffed animal gripped tightly to her chest with arms thin as twigs. Amy saw her too. She sheathed her sword and dashed forward. The virals were charging down the dock. The little girl was frozen with terror. Amy swung her onto her hip and began to run. With her free hand, she waved Peter forward.
Don't wait. I'll need you to catch us.
He raced down the dry dock door. The bottom of the gangway was 30 feet away and closing fast. Caleb yelled, Do it now! Peter leapt. For an instant, it seemed he had jumped too soon. He would plunge into the roiling water. But then his hands caught the rail of the gangway. He pulled himself up, found his footing, and turned around. Amy, still holding the girl, was running down the top of the wall. The gangway was passing them by. She was never going to make it. Peter reached out as Amy took 5 bounding strides, each longer than the last, and flung herself over the abyss. Peter could not remember the moment when he grabbed her hand. Only that he'd done it. They had cleared the dock. Michael ran down from the pilot house and dashed to the rail. He saw a deep dent, 50 feet long at least, though the wound was high above the waterline. He looked toward shore. 100 yards aft, at the end of the dock, a mass of virals was watching the departing ship like a crowd of mourners.
Help!
The voice came from the stern.
Someone's fallen!
He raced aft. A woman, clutching an infant, was pointing over the rail.
I didn't know she was going to jump.
Who? Who was it?
She was on a stretcher. She could barely walk. She said her name was Alicia.
A coiled rope lay on the deck. Michael pushed the button on the radio.
Lore, kill the props.
What?
Do it. Full stop.
He was already wrapping the rope around his waist, having shoved the radio into the hand of the woman who stared at him in confusion.
Where are you going? The woman asked.
He stepped over the rail. Far below, the waters swirled in a maelstrom. Kill them, he thought. Dear God, Lore,
Kill those screws now.
He jumped. Toes pointed, arms outstretched, he pierced the surface like a spike. Instantly the current grabbed him, shoving him down. He slammed into the mucky bottom and began to roll along it. His eyes stung with salt. He could see nothing at all, not even his hands. He fell straight into her. A confusion of limbs. They were both tumbling, spiraling along the bottom. He grabbed her belt and drew her body into his and wrapped his arms around her waist. The slack ran out. A hard yank. Michael felt as if he were being sliced in two. Still holding Alicia, he vaulted upward at a 45-degree angle. Michael had already been in the water for 30 seconds. His brain was screaming for air. The screws had stopped turning, but this no longer mattered. They were being pulled along by the boat's momentum. Unless they broke the surface soon, they'd drown. Suddenly, a whining sound. The screws had re-engaged.
No!
Then Michael realized what had happened. Lore had reversed the engines. The tension on the rope began to soften, then was gone. A new force gripped them. They were being sucked forward, toward the spiraling props. They were going to be chopped to bits. Michael looked up. High above, the surface shimmered. What was the source of this mysterious, beckoning light? The sound of the screws abruptly ceased. Now he understood Laura's intentions. She was creating enough slack in the line for them to ascend. Michael began to kick. Alicia, don't give up. Help me do this. Unless you do, we're dead. But it was no use. They were sinking like stones. The light receded pitilessly. The rope went taut again. They were being pulled. As they broke the surface, Michael opened his mouth wide, sucking in a vast gulp of air. They were beneath the stern, a mountain of steel soaring above them. The light he'd seen was the moon. It shone down upon them, fat and full, spilling across the surface of the water.
It's all right. I've got you, Michael said.
Alicia was coughing and sputtering in his arms. From high above, a lifeboat floated down.
I've got you. I've got you. I've got you.
77. Carter's eyes were full of stars. He lay on the causeway, bloodied and broken. Some parts of him felt as if they were absent, no longer attached. There was no pain. Rather, his body felt distant, beyond his command. Brothers. Sisters. They stood around him in a circle. Toward them, he felt only love. The ship was gone. It was streaming away. He felt a great love for everything. He would have wrapped the world with his heart if he could. At the edge of the causeway, moonlight skittered across the water, making a glowing road for him to travel. Let me do this. Let me feel it coming out of me. Let me be a man again before I die. Carter began to crawl. The virals stepped back, allowing him to pass. There was in their comportment a feeling of respect, as if they were pupils or soldiers accepting the sword of their enemy. Across the roadway, Carter made his passage. His left hand, reaching out, was the first part of him to touch the sea. The water was cool and welcoming, rich with salt and earth. A billion living things coursed through it. To them he would be joined. Brothers, sisters, I thank you. He slipped beneath the surface of the water. 11. The City of Mirrors. I wear the chain I forged in life. I made it link by link and yard by yard. I girded it on of my own free will, and of my own free will I wore it. Charles Dickens, A Christmas Carol. 78. Dawn at sea. The Bergensfjord lay at anchor, her great engines at rest. The sky was low, the water blank as stone. Far away, a screen of rain fell into the gulf. Most of the passengers were sleeping on the deck. Their bodies lay in disorder, as if felled all at once. They were 100 miles from land. Amy stood at the bow, Peter beside her. Her mind was drifting, refusing to attach to any thought but one. Anthony was gone. She was all that remained. The little girl's name was Rebecca. Her mother had died in the attack, her father years ago. Amy's feeling of her, her body's weight and heat, the desperate force with which she'd clung to her as they had soared through space, was still palpable. Amy did not think it would ever depart. The sensation had become a part of her, stitched to her bones. It had defined the moment, making the choice for her. It was not only Rebecca that Amy had seen on the pier, but her own little girl self, who had, after all, been just as alone, abandoned by the great heaving engine of the world, and in need of saving. For some time, perhaps 10 minutes, neither she nor Peter spoke. Like her, Peter was only half present, staring into space. The pale dawn sky, the sea, limitlessly calm. It was Amy who broke the silence. "You better go talk to her." In the small hours of the night, a decision had been reached. Amy could not go. Neither could Alicia. If the survivors were going to make a new life for themselves, all traces of the old terrors needed to be left behind. What mattered now was for others to accept it. "She didn't do this, Peter." He glanced at her, but said nothing. "Neither did you," she added. Another silence. With all her heart, she wanted him to believe this. Yet she knew it was impossible for him to think otherwise. "You need to make peace with her, Peter. For both your sakes." The sun was rising unremarkably behind the clouds. The sky was devoid of color, its edges blended imperceptibly into the horizon. The rain kept its distance. Michael had assured them that the weather wouldn't be a problem. He knew how to read these things. "Well," Peter said with a sigh, "I suppose I better do this." He left her and descended to the crew's quarters. The air below decks was cooler, smelling of wet metal and rust. Most of Michael's men were snoring in their racks, using this brief hiatus to rest and prepare themselves for what lay ahead. Alicia lay on a lower bunk at the far end of the corridor. Peter pulled up a stool and cleared his throat. "So." Staring upward, she had yet to look at him. "Say what's on your mind." He wasn't entirely sure what that was. "I'm sorry I tried to strangle you." Or, "What were you thinking?" Perhaps he meant, "Go to hell." "I'm here to offer a truce." "A truce," Alicia repeated. "Sounds like Amy's idea." "You tried to kill yourself, Lish. And it would have worked, too, if Michael hadn't decided to be the hero. I've got a bit of a bone to pick with the guy. Did you think the water would change you back?" "Would it make you feel better if I did?" She blew out her breath. "I'm afraid that's not an option for me." Fanning was pretty clear on that score. "No. I'd have to say that drowning was pretty much the goal." "I can't believe that. Peter, what do you want? If you're here to pity me, I'm not interested." "I'm aware of that." "What you mean to say is that you need me." He nodded. "That would be fair. And under the circumstances, it's best if we bury the hatchet. Comrades, brothers in arms, no division within the ranks." "More or less, yes." With painful slowness, she turned her face toward him. "Want to know what I was thinking? While your hands were around my throat, I mean. If you want to tell me." I was thinking, well, if anybody's going to strangle me, I'm glad it's my old friend Peter. She'd spoken these words without bitterness. She was merely stating a fact. I was wrong, he said. You didn't deserve it. I don't know what's between you and Fanning. I doubt I'll ever get it, frankly. But I sold you short. She weighed his words, then shrugged. So, you screwed up. Short of an outright apology, I guess I'll have to take that. I guess you will. She gave him a look of warning. I said I can get you in there, and I can. But you're throwing your life away. I'd say it's the opposite. Alicia made a sound that began as a laugh, but turned into a cough. Deep, hacking, her eyes clamped shut with pain. Peter waited for it to subside. Lish, are you all right? Her cheeks were flushed. Spittle flecked her lips. Do I look all right? On the whole, you've seemed better. She shook her head indulgently, the way a mother might with a hopeless child. You never change, Peter. 50 years I've known you, and you're still the same guy. Maybe that's why I can't stay mad at you. And I'll take that. He stood. Need anything before we leave? A new body would be nice. This one seems to have run its course. Short of that. Alicia thought for a moment, then smiled. I don't know. How about another rabbit? He found his son on deck, sitting on a wooden crate and watching Michael making his preparations on the fantail. You mind? He asked. Caleb scooted over. Where's Pim? Asleep. His son turned and gave him a hard look. Help me understand this. I'm not sure I can. Then why? What difference could it possibly make now? People will come back someday. If Fanning's still alive, it starts all over again. You're going because of her. Peter was speechless. Oh, don't look so surprised, Caleb went on. I've known about it for years. Peter didn't know how to respond. In the end, he could only admit the truth. Well, you're right. Of course I'm right. Let me finish. Amy does have something to do with this, but she's not the only reason. He brought his thoughts into focus. Here's the best way I have to explain it. It's a story about your father. At the colony, we had a tradition. We called it standing the mercy. When a person was taken up, a relative would wait for them each night on the city wall. We'd set out a cage with a lamb inside as bait. 7 nights, waiting for them to come home. And if they did, it was that person's job to kill them. It was usually the responsibility of the closest male relative. So when your father disappeared, I had to stand for him. Caleb was watching his face closely. How old were you? 20, 21, just a kid. But he didn't come back. He'd been taken to the Haven. Yes, but I didn't know that. 7 nights, Caleb. That's a lot of time to think about killing a person, especially my own brother. At the start, I wondered if I actually could. Our parents had died. Theo was the only person I had left in the world. But as the nights passed, I came to understand something. There was something worse than killing him, and that would be letting somebody else do it. If the situation were reversed, if I had been the one taken up, I wouldn't have wanted it any other way. I didn't want to do it, believe me. But I owed him that much. The responsibility was mine, and no one else's. Peter gave his words a moment to sink in. That's what this is like, son. I don't know why it has to be me. That's a question I can't answer. But it doesn't matter. Pim and the kids, those are your responsibilities. You were put on Earth to protect them till your last breath. That's your job. This is mine. You need to let me do it. Aboard the Nautilus, Michael was issuing instructions to the crewmen who would assist in launching her. The hull had been wrapped in thick rope webbing. A steel boom and a system of blocks would be used to lift her from her cradle and lower her over the side. Once she was in the water, they would cut her free, raise the mast, and set sail for New York.
"He'll kill you," Caleb said.
Peter said nothing.
"And if you succeed, Amy can't leave. You said so yourself."
"No, she can't."
"So what then?"
"Then I live my life, just like you're going to live yours." Peter waited for his son to say more. When he didn't, he put his hand on Caleb's shoulder.
"You have to accept this, son.
It's not easy. I know it's not." Caleb tipped his face upward. He swallowed hard and said, "When I was a kid, my friends always talked about you. Some of what they said was true. A lot of it was total bullshit. The funny thing was, I felt bad for you. I won't say I didn't like the attention, but I also knew you didn't want people to think of you like that. It kind of stumped me. Who wouldn't want to be a big deal, some kind of hero? Then one day it hit me. You felt that way because of me. I was the choice you'd made, and the rest didn't matter to you anymore. You would have been perfectly happy if the world just forgot about you. It's true. That's how I saw it. I felt so goddamn lucky. When you started working for Sanchez, I thought things might change. But they never did." He looked at Peter again. "So now you ask me if I can just let you go. Well, I can't. I don't have that in me. But I do understand." They sat without speaking for a time. Around them, the ship was waking up, passengers rising, stretching their limbs. Did that really happen? They thought, their eyes blinking against an unfamiliar oceanic light. Am I really on a ship? Is that the sun? The sea? How stunned they must be, thought Peter, by the infinite calm of it all. Voices accumulated, mostly the children, for whom a night of terror, abruptly and in a manner completely unforeseen, had opened a door to an entirely new existence. They had gone to sleep in one world, and awakened in another, so dissimilar as to seem perhaps an altogether different version of reality. As the minutes passed, many of the passengers were drawn magnetically to the rail, pointing, whispering, chattering among themselves. As he listened, memories poured through him, as well as a sense of all the things he would never see. Michael walked toward them. The man's eyes darted toward Caleb, quickly sizing up the situation, then back to Peter. Shuffling his hands in his pockets, he said gently, almost as if he were apologizing, "The supplies are all aboard. I think we're about ready here." Peter nodded. "Okay." But he made no move to do anything about this. "Do you want me to tell the others?"
"I think that would be good."
Michael walked away. Peter turned to his son.
"Caleb, I'm all right."
He rose from the crate, holding himself stiffly, like a man with a wound.
"I'll get Pim and the children."
Everyone gathered at the Nautilus. Lore and Rand operated the winch that hoisted Alicia, still strapped to her stretcher, to the cockpit. Michael and Peter carried her down to the boat's small cabin, then descended the ladder to join the others. Caleb and his family, Sarah and Hollis. Greer, who had rebounded well enough from the crash to join them on deck, though his head was bandaged and he stood unsteadily, one hand braced against the hull of the Nautilus, Everywhere on the ship, people were watching. The story had spread. It was 0830 hours. The final goodbyes. No one knew where to start. It was Amy who broke the stalemate. She embraced Lucius, the two of them exchanging quiet words that no one else could hear. Then Sarah, and then Hollis, who of everyone, more so even than Sarah, seemed undone by the weight of it all, hugging Amy tightly against his chest. But of course, Sarah was steeling herself. Her composure was a ruse. She would not go to Michael. She simply could not bear to. Finally, as the various farewells proceeded around them, it was he who went to her.
"Oh, damn you, Michael," she said miserably. "Why are you always doing this to me?"
"I guess it's my talent." She wrapped her arms around him, tears squeezed from the corners of her eyes.
"I lied to you, Michael. I never gave you up. Not for a day."
They parted. Michael turned to Lore. "I guess this is it.
You always knew that you wouldn't be going, didn't you?"
Michael didn't answer.
"Oh, hell," Lore said. "I guess I kinda knew it, too."
"Take care of my ship," Michael said. "I'm counting on you." Lore took his cheeks in her hands and kissed him, long and tenderly.
"Stay safe, Michael."
He climbed aboard the Nautilus. At the base of the ladder, Peter shook Greer's hand, then Hollis's. He hugged Sarah long and hard. He had already said goodbye to Pim and the children. His son would be the last. Caleb was standing to the side. His eyes were tight, withholding tears. He would not cry. Peter felt suddenly as if he were marching to his death. Likewise was he struck, as never before, by a sense of pride. This strong man before him, Caleb, his son, his boy. Peter pulled him into a firm embrace. He would not hold on long. If he did, he might not let go. "It's children," he thought, "that give us our lives. Without them, we are nothing. We are here and then gone, like the dust." A few seconds, recording all he could, and he stepped back.
"I love you, son. You make me very proud."
He climbed the ladder to join the others on the deck. Rand and Lore began to crank the winch. The Nautilus rose from her cradle and swung over the side. With a soft splash, the boat settled into the water.
"Okay, hold us there," Michael called up.
They used their knives to cut the net. It passed beneath their stern, half floating, then was dragged under the surface by its weight. Peter and Amy attached the guy wires while Michael set the lines that would pull the mast erect. They had begun to drift away from the Bergensfjord. When everything was ready, Michael commenced turning the winch. The mast rose into position. He locked it in place and unstrapped the sail from the boom. The distance to the Bergensfjord had increased to 50 yards. The air was warming, with a gentle breeze. The great ship's engines had come on. A new sound emerged, one of chains. Beneath the Bergensfjord's bow, the anchor appeared, water streaming as it ascended. The ship's rail was lined with faces. People were watching them. Some began to wave.
"Okay. We're ready," Michael said.
They raised the mainsail. It flapped emptily, but then Michael pulled the tiller to one side and the bow veered slowly off the wind. With a pop, the canvas filled.
"We'll raise the jib once we're clear," said Michael.
Their velocity was, to Peter, quite startling. The boat, heeling slightly, possessed a stable feel, the point of its bow slicing cleanly through the water. The Bergensfjord receded behind them. The sky seemed infinitely deep. It happened gradually. Then all at once. They were alone.
79.
Log of the